I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. By now, the hijinks and hazards of fraternity life are well known, but have things finally reached a breaking point? Today, we'll find out why activity was frozen recently at 24 University of Kansas frats and why all new member activity was paused for 2 weeks at the University of Missouri. Then we sit down with a leader of one of Kansas's most visible LGBT advocacy groups. We'll find out what Equality Kansas thinks of the new Collier administration and hear its plans for affecting change in Topeka. This week's Local Listen is last with Bill Brownlee. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Lawsuits, broken jaws, unending allegations of hazing, health and safety violations. Fraternities at the University of Kansas and the University of Missouri are under siege these days for bad behavior. They're facing a series of accusations that's resulting in crackdowns and new rounds of discipline. In Columbia, the MU Interfraternity Council is pausing all new member activities until Monday in response to hazing allegations. In Lawrence, the Interfraternity Council at KU has imposed a temporary freeze on activities for the 24 fraternities it governs. The issue there, systemic problems related to hazing and, in the case of one house, alleged sexual assaults. Whether this impacts the future of fraternities on the campuses remains to be seen. We'll talk about problems on both campuses during this segment of the show, and we'll start with KU. Joining us now, Sarah Shepard's a reporter at the Lawrence Journal World. She's a public safety reporter and former higher education reporter. Sarah, it's always good to have you. Welcome back. Hope to have Sarah here. Sarah Brown is a reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's reported on higher education and fraternity issues nationwide. Sarah, nice to have you. You there, Sarah?
Sarah Shepard is here. Sorry.
Sarah, I'm glad Sarah Shepard's here. We hope to have Sarah Brown here in a minute, too. Sarah Brown, are you here? Okay. Claire Mitzel is a junior at Mizzou and a reporter for The Missourian. Claire, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Nathan Lawrence is the digital content director for KBIA, who has reported on fraternity issues at Missouri for several years. Nathan, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Sir, let me start with you, Sarah Shepard, at the Lawrence Journal World. Your story yesterday mentioned systemic conduct problems at KU fraternities. That sounds fairly all-encompassing. Do we know exactly what that means?
We don't know exactly, but we have some clues. So the university or the IFC leaders aren't specifically saying, you know, this happened at this date, at this house. But over time, KU has a list of discipline that it's taken against the houses dating back for the past 10 years or so. That I would say that hazing is the most common recurring behavior that's been disciplined by KU at numerous houses, some repeatedly. And then just recently, three KU fraternities were suspended by their own national associations, and at least one of those did say specifically that hazing was the culprit.
When we talk about hazing, Sarah Shepard, we're talking about this, you know, this ritual that takes place during the initiation of new members into a frat. I mean, this practice is as old as the hills, isn't it?
I haven't been involved in it, but I would say that's probably a true statement. And I think where the problem becomes is if it turns into behavior that's harmful, embarrassing, traumatizing, and like I said, at worst, physically harmful or abusive to anyone involved, obviously that's not acceptable.
Do you have specific examples of the kinds of things that have occurred at KU in recent years that the university and the Infraternity Council is saying, no more?
Well, a little bit broadly first, KU's policy defines hazing as basically any activity where certain people are meant to feel ridiculed. It could be as small as making freshmen, you know, mop the floor when other upperclassmen don't have to do it, or it could be as serious as causing great bodily harm or injury on someone, forced drinking, et cetera. So it's very broad, and we don't have a lot of examples about what specific behavior led to these hazing violations. Wish we did. It's been an ongoing dispute between the journal world and the university to try to get more details, but we haven't had many. There's one circumstance which was particularly tragic some years back where KU did, this was back in, I believe, 2010. At the time, KU did release details about the hazing that their investigation found occurred. The end result, a pledge dived into a makeshift pool at a KU fraternity and was seriously injured, reportedly broke his back and was partially paralyzed. KU never found that hazing actually led to that injury, but they did find that regarding that party, people were made to wear costumes and ridiculed, drinking was involved, and some other more specific problems. But as to more recent activities, unfortunately, the fraternities themselves or the university hasn't provided examples of what kind of hazing we're talking about.
Sarah Shepard, one more question about the Kansas side of the state line, then I'll flip over to the Missouri side. So at KU, there's been this temporary freeze on activities that's been instituted at 24 KU frats. What does that mean?
Basically, that means the frats we're talking about are the typical ones of the big houses and the pillars. It doesn't include some of the traditionally African-American fraternities or some of the multicultural ones. But the temporary freeze freezes essentially all social activity, specifically any social activity with alcohol. The fraternities are still allowed to have chapter meetings. The men can live in the houses. They can do community service. And it appears that they're allowed to have certain events like possibly parents' meetings, as long as they're alcohol-free. It also, and this is pretty key, the new freeze also makes some significant changes to recruitment. Until further notice, all fraternity recruitment activities have to be totally dry. They have to be supervised. Pledges aren't allowed, or I'm sorry, potential new members aren't allowed to spend nights in fraternity houses. And things have to be approved in advance. So they're also sort of cracking down on that as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about problems at fraternities on both sides of the state line at MU and at KU. Let's flip over to the Missouri side of the state line here and bring in Claire Mitzel again. She's a junior at Mizzou and a reporter for the Missourian newspaper. You know, so much of what is happening at MU is similar to the story over at KU, Claire. You reported last week that the MU Interfraternity Council has announced that it was pausing all new member activities until this coming Monday. In response, again, here's this word, hazing allegations. What do we know about what triggered this decision?
Right. So similar to KU, we aren't sure what specifically those hazing allegations are. We know that IFC at Mizzou was made aware of allegations against multiple fraternities. We also don't know the specific number of fraternities, but we do know that it is multiple fraternities who have these allegations against them. And so they had announced that all 29 chapter presidents agreed to unanimously pause those new member activities until to give time for IFC to conduct an investigation with the national headquarters for those fraternity chapters who have those alleged allegations against them in MU's Office of Student Accountability and Support.
Nathan Lawrence with KBIA over in Columbia. I mean, this notion that there's a crackdown on hazing reminds me of the line from Casablanca where, you know, there's gambling in this establishment. Are you kidding me? Don't hazing and fraternity life go hand in hand? And they have for decades in this country.
I think that there's certainly sort of it does sort of fall into this category of an open secret. Everybody knows that hazing of some kind is happening, and really, I think part of the vagueness here is around that. Sarah mentioned that there's this real challenge in identifying what hazing actually means when a university says there's hazing involved, because it can be anything from, you know, chores to really serious things that could get someone hurt or killed, and part of that unclarity, that lack of transparency, is what makes this such a complicated and intense issue for us, I think.
You know, Nathan, from April 2015 to October 2016, we're talking about a year and a few months span there, at least 14 frats at MU were placed on probation. I mean, that's a lot. Three frats were suspended. What was going on then?
Well, it does vary a little bit from chapter to chapter, but there are certain sort of key words and phrases that do seem to stick out in every single report about those incidents. And those are words like alcohol, words like hazing, in some cases, issues of race or sexual misconduct, which is another one of those phrases that really sort of hides the actual issues at play, and we don't know all the specifics involved. But there are definitely some sort of key issues that seem to be endemic cultural issues in the entire Greek system at a place like Mizzou.
You begin to get a sense that the system is unraveling over there, Nathan, or am I reaching too far?
That's a good question. I was asking myself that this morning as I was pulling some things together, because it's not as if all of this is totally new. In 2014, there's a particularly horrific incident where a student fell to his death at a recruitment party, and that was an alcohol-involved incident, of course. And, you know, I was thinking about, is there a point of inflection happening here? Are we reaching a point where things are going to substantially change? But I think back to 2014, and I think back to the fact that we're having these problems now. I wonder if this is sort of a cycle and if things aren't going to really change or move forward.
Well, let me bring in, get a national perspective here. Sarah Brown, a reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she's reported on higher ed and fraternity issues nationwide. Sarah, again, it's nice to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, again, these problems, you know, the notion of there are issues with hazing and drinking in fraternities, I mean, hello. I mean, this has been going on forever. What's your sense of what's leading to this crackdown across the country right now, or at least in Kansas and Missouri?
You're right. There have been a lot of recent shutdowns, temporary suspensions of fraternity chapters, or campus-wide shutdowns of fraternity social activities. That's something that you're seeing more nationwide. And, you know, it's not new. It kind of ebbs and flows. Sometimes in a given academic year, there are a lot of hazing cases and chapter suspensions, and they draw a lot of attention. Other times, it's a little less prominent. It does seem as though there has been heightened attention on fraternity misconduct for the past year or so in particular. A big part of that, I think, is because of Timothy Piazza. He was a fraternity pledge at Penn State who died last year, became very intoxicated, fell downstairs, and then did not receive the medical help he needed because other members of the fraternity did not call 911 for nearly 12 hours. Unfortunately, wow. There are a handful, at least, of deaths related to hazing incidents just about every year, which is very tragic. What was different in this case is that most of the events of that evening were recorded on security cameras that were inside the house. So the general public saw all of this, you know, his worsening condition, the fraternity members in action. People saw all of this unfold in grim detail. And I think to some extent that's really changed the conversation about fraternity misconduct.
You know, in the interest of full disclosure, Sarah Brown, I was never a frat guy, and I've always wondered about, you know, these programs. And I understand there are benefits and upsides to them and connections and all that kind of thing. But help me understand here, this notion of sticking 50, 19, and 20, 21-year-old men in a house and expecting good behavior, I mean, what planet are we living on here?
Right. So the argument that supporters of Greek Life make, and there are a lot of supporters of Greek Life, a lot mm-hmm. of alumni who feel very strongly about their membership in these organizations, they say, you know, these chapters are really important in terms of helping students find a community on campus. They say, you know, they do a lot of philanthropic work and volunteer work, and they can also help students start to build a professional network. So, you know, fraternity and sorority members can end up being great connections to have when you're starting off your career. Supporters will also often say that many, if not most, of the problems are limited to a few bad apples, and that, you know, the vast majority of fraternities are not engaging in serious misconduct. I think, you know, you'll hear those arguments, but for a lot of folks, they are starting to ring increasingly hollow, especially when more and more students are dying in these hazing incidents and alcohol-related problems.
I was going to say, Sarah Brown, this notion that there are just a few bad apples out there, that argument appears to be waning right here in Missouri and Kansas based on what our guests are saying about the problems at fraternities in both KU and at MU.
Yes, and again, you are seeing more college leaders taking steps in recent months to crack down on Greek Life. And so the appetite for reform seems more significant, but, you know, one of the other guests mentioned a cycle. What we do often see with fraternities is that there is a cycle. Something happens, whether it's hazing, sexual misconduct, something like that, really serious problems, of course, or perhaps something very, very tragic, like the death of a student. The university president will condemn the event. The fraternity chapter is shut down. People get angry. They say the status quo is unacceptable and things must change. The university might create a task force that produces recommendations. But then as time passes and the news cycle moves on, not a lot of really significant change happens. And part of that is because fundamentally, fraternities are private organizations, and the university doesn't have a ton of control over how they operate. And then when something else bad happens, the cycle starts all over again.
We're talking about problems at fraternities across the country, and more specifically at MU and KU. If our listeners want to join this conversation with questions or comments about what they're hearing here, has the time for Greek life maybe come to an end? Maybe, or maybe that's going too far. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Claire Mitzel, again, a reporter for the Missourian over in Columbia. Who's leading this charge of this call for investigation into the frats at MU? Is it the administration of the university? Is it this interfraternity council? Who's spearheading this thing?
So IFC was the one who was made aware initially of these allegations.
IFC being the Interfraternity Council, right?
Correct. Yeah. And then they got in touch with the university, and now it's a joint collaboration between IFC, that council, and the university. So IFC is the one initially who brought that up. And the university has said in a statement that they are glad that the council is being proactive in halting these activities until an investigation can be done before something, you know, bad happens.
And Claire, who has the power here to discipline? Is it the council, or is it the university, or is it both?
Nathan might be able to answer that more than I can.
Nathan Lawrence, hop in here.
So this is a very interesting thing. I also want to add very briefly that the university is definitely aware that there are issues here. One of the things that's been happening is there's been a move to really restructure the way that Greek life's handled at the university. But this actually relates directly to your point about who has the power here, which is the university's power is actually extremely limited, because most of these fraternities exist as, you know, components to the university somehow, but they're on private property. So the university police can, you know, knock on the door, but if they're not invited in, then they need probable cause just like any other police. Similarly, we see, you know, the university can suspend a fraternity, but that doesn't mean the fraternity stops existing. It just means that the university doesn't have any control over them anymore. And there was a strategic report that sort of said that a lot of fraternities were existing secretly. So one of the few organizations who does have control are the national and international chapters that can choose to disassociate from those fraternities.
But those chapters, those are people who are far away from the campuses that are being looked at, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. And they're usually the last people to hear about a serious problem. We've found several cases. In fact, one's being sued right now over claims of negligence related to hearing about things and then not doing anything.
Nathan, again, one other point here I wanted to get you to comment on. In October, a consulting firm known as Dyad Strategies released a report critical of MU Greek life that recommended that freshmen no longer live in frat houses. The report also said that fraternities should register all social events and that the university work with the Interfraternity Council to provide security and inspect chapter houses during registered events. Why was that firm retained to begin with, and what's been the impact of its work?
Absolutely. So the firm in question, which was sort of retained as a part of this review of the entire way that campus life is operating, and there's been a real focus on Greek life as a part of that. I was referencing that earlier with some of the issues about enforcement and things like that they'd pointed out. We've yet to see a really profound impact. There's been some serious shakeup in the way those offices are organized, but that's really the extent that we've seen change so far. And to be honest, that's where a lot of the report was focused. So I'm not sure how in-depth with fraternity conduct we're actually going to get here.
I mean, these are pretty dramatic recommendations, right?
I don't know. I think that they're pretty dramatic recommendations if they're followed, and they're followed by the fraternities. But I could see register all social events quickly turning into please register all social events, which quickly turns into all social events are supposed to be registered, which quickly turns into nobody registers their social events.
Hmm.
We see all the time these sorts of policies for students that just don't get followed through on because they're more or less unenforceable.
How did frats react to that report and to these new, I guess, requirements or requests?
I didn't actually see a lot of change in fraternity behavior, and I certainly have not heard a lot of uproar from alumni or individual fraternities, but maybe Claire disagrees.
I would agree with that. I think fraternities at Mizzou, at least, typically don't put out a lot of statements. For example, with the recent new member activity pause, we tried contacting various fraternities, and they either said no comment or they referred us to their national headquarters because they all want to say have similar statements, I think, and don't want to go against the grain.
Sarah Shepard, again, with the Lawrence Journal World on the Kansas side. I was struck by your story the other day that talked about how the newspaper finds out about issues involving sororities and fraternities, how difficult that is. You've alluded to that already here this morning. And you have to file open records requests, and then when you get them back, big chunks are redacted. Why is this all so shrouded in secrecy here?
Well, like I said, our point was we felt like as university-registered organizations, the university is disciplining them and should provide a little more information about the extent of the hazing we're dealing with. Did someone die? Did someone get injured? I assume we would have heard about it in the newspaper if it got that bad, but we don't know. Or is it just cleaning? In redacting those documents, the university cited the Federal Privacy Act that is supposed to require schools to not release any information about individual students. However, we believe as entire organizations, this discipline shouldn't fall under that. And the university's argument was that the groups were small enough that if some information was released, someone might be able to figure out some of the individuals involved and therefore would be a violation of FERPA, that Federal Privacy Act. Again, we disagree with that application and have had several national experts disagree as well, but that perhaps somewhat explains the university's stance on that. And why we haven't been able to get more details, even though we have the documents that they're all in, they've been blacked out.
So, Sarah Shepard, bottom line is, at least in Lawrence, when it comes to KU, finding out what's going on is pretty tough to do.
I would say yes. And I would say, you know, as a police reporter, if some situation rose to the level of newsworthiness on the crime beat, like there's a death or an extreme injury or a huge brawl where many police responded, we would learn about that through other means. But I don't think typically that's what's happening, at least not that we know of. That seems unusual. I think it's lower scale things that may not be acceptable, but they're not that big.
Claire Mitzel, again, over at the Missourian, how difficult is it to find out what's happening inside frats over in Columbia?
It's similar difficulty. We have an easier time after the fact. For example, in fall 2016, the Missourian did a really big story. We got a bunch of documents looking at fraternity suspensions between that April 2015 October 2016 period, and the reporters who worked on that story were able to piece together what happened. But a lot of times, we don't know specifics until a while after. For example, just yesterday, actually, one of our fraternity chapters, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, was suspended for multiple health and safety violations, but we don't yet know exactly what those specific violations were.
Health violations, what might that be?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. They were placed under a cease and desist order in December, so I don't believe this is related to that hazing allegations most recently. This has been going on for a little bit, but once they completed that investigation, they decided to suspend them for at least no fewer than 4 years, it said. But I'm not sure. Maybe Nathan might know a little more about what that might entail.
To be honest, this has been a puzzle to me as well. Health and safety is another one of those phrases. This is an increasing thing where we get these phrases like health and safety or hazing or sexual misconduct that are just blanket phrases that can mean anything in a variety of levels of severity. And then all we get back are these stone walls because of FERPA or Title IX reasons. And it is making it very difficult to bring any sort of transparency to these situations.
Sarah Brown, again, a reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education. We have a question here from Richard from Grain Valley who tweeted us and asked us this. Why are Greeks allowed to have an affiliation with a university? He suggests that shouldn't be allowed.
Well, the relationship between universities and Greek life is a somewhat difficult one. you know, I think at the universities where they've been sort of most successful in, I guess, building a better relationship, they've really had to take the time to sit down and work with Greek leaders to implement changes of various kinds. I guess one argument that folks will make that, you know, is why it's actually a good thing for Greek organizations to be affiliated with the university is that if the fraternities go underground, then all of the misconduct occurs sort of out of sight, and that can be even more dangerous. I mean, it's already a challenge for university officials to monitor social events that fraternities hold, for example, but if the fraternity goes underground, then all of it happens completely under the radar, and that can be really dangerous. And so I think that's, again, one argument that folks will make in support of having a sort of university affiliation, at least some kind of relationship there, even if it's a really difficult one at times.
Sarah Shepard, again, with the Lawrence Journal World. Tell us about one frat you wrote about, the newly defunct KU chapter of Sigma Alpha Epsilon. What happened there?
Yeah. I really quick want to add to what Sarah Brown just said about the organizations, too. I also think it's important to remember that sororities and fraternities, they are student organizations, just like many, many, many other clubs that are registered with the university and associated with them. And so it's not like they're unusual in that. And they're groups where students, you know, do philanthropy, have social activities, and so forth. They're unique, but they do fall under the same umbrella as
sure.
many, many other groups at the university. So there's that, too, which is noteworthy.
So what happened to Sigma Alpha Epsilon?
It's interesting to hear the Mizzou folks talk about this, because Sigma Alpha Epsilon at KU was just in the past week, I believe, announced that it would be shut down at KU. They use the word possibly suspended, but essentially, more accurately, they've been shut down for at least 4 years. So basically, they've been kicked off campus, and that decision was made by their own national association. And they cited language that sounds just like Mizzou, that was very, very vague about concerns over health and safety, et cetera, but didn't cite any specific examples. And so that is one, I believe that's, at least in recently, that's the only fraternity that has been totally shut down. While several others have been, you know, suspended or placed on probation, that fraternity will go away from KU altogether for at least 4 years.
Sarah Brown with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Let's wrap this up. You know, are you sensing, as you look across the country, are we at a pivot point when it comes to frats in this country, or what are you sensing?
There's certainly an appetite for fraternity reform, and I think it's a bit stronger than I've seen it in my time covering Greek life. We'll see if things are different this time around, but it's tough to say, right? I think, you know, there are universities that have taken more steps to change things, but even if there are tighter restrictions, how do you enforce them? If you look at, you know, if you look at Penn State, which had the really horrific death last year of the fraternity pledge and the hazing incident, I mean, campus officials did one really pretty significant thing, and they took over the disciplinary process for fraternities and sororities. So instead of the IFC sort of handling all the disciplinary issues and deciding punishments, now campus officials do it. So that's a pretty significant change to the fraternity self-governance that's been a hallmark of the Greek system for a long time. So perhaps that signals some kind of a broader shift, but we'll see. You know, I'll mention another thing briefly on SAE, Sigma Alpha Epsilon. The national organization actually, a couple of years ago, eliminated the pledging process and initiation for new members. So that's considered a really dangerous period of time where a lot of the hazing occurs. And so they replaced it with what they call this quote-unquote period of holistic education. So on the one hand, of course, that change has not stopped all of the misconduct, clearly, if AU and MU are any indication. On the other hand, if you see, you know, the national organization taking this quick step to shut down the organization, it might signal that, you know, there's more sort of there's more impetus for really cracking down here, and so that might be what we're seeing.
Okay, that's Sarah Brown with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Shepard with the Lawrence Journal World also joined us. Claire Mitzel, a junior at Mizzou, a reporter for the Missourian, and Nathan Lawrence with KBIA. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about LGBT rights when it comes to state employees in Kansas. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we sat down with Kansas City, Missouri's city manager, Troy Schulte. You can hear his thoughts on working with the mayor and city council to get things done in town. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. That's where we post a podcast version of every episode, kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we welcome back opera star Joyce DiDonato back to the show and learn what the Prairie Village's world-renowned mezzo-soprano has been up to lately. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas Governor Jeff Collier is declining to say whether he will reinstate an executive order prohibiting discrimination against LGBT state workers. Former Governor Kathleen Sebelius had signed just such an order in 2007, but in 2015, Governor Sam Brownback rescinded it. His decision means that state agencies today can deny a job to applicants just because they are gay, lesbian, or transgender. So how is the most visible LGBT advocate in the Kansas Capitol reacting to this news and to the state's new governor? We're about to find out. Tom Witt is executive director of Equality Kansas. That's a group with a mission of ending discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Tom, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Steve, thanks for having me on today. It's good to see you.
I should point out that I'm a member of the STARS editorial board, and we have called for the governor to sign a new executive order extending protections to the LGBT community. You know, what's your reaction, Tom, to the governor's decision to remain mum on whether he would reinstate an executive order prohibiting discrimination against LGBT state workers? What do you make of it?
Well, I'd like to say we were surprised, but we're not. Jeff Collier, when he was a state representative and then a state senator, had a history of siding with the hard right social conservatives on LGBT equality issues. We don't look at him as a supporter of our community.
Are you holding out any hope that, you know, he's still reviewing this matter and maybe he's going to sign it in the weeks to come?
What we see is him trying to do a little political dance to not get pinned down on an issue. I don't think hope really enters into our thoughts about the governor.
Have you had a chance to meet with him, Tom, and talk to him about what your concerns are and what you think needs to happen here?
Not yet. We are going to try to ask for a meeting and see how that goes. We kind of want to get through this legislative session first and see what kind of bills are moved against the community, whether or not he's going to talk about wanting to sign those bills.
Are there bills out there that are moving against your community?
Well, we just found out yesterday that a so-called religious freedom bill is going to get a hearing in the House Fed and State Affairs Committee next Tuesday and Wednesday. And what this bill would do is allow taxpayer-funded adoption and foster placement agencies to deny placements in LGBT households. So we're gearing up for that fight, and we're going to be watching what the governor does and says very closely and very carefully.
You know, executive orders that we're talking about here in connection with Governor Collier are significant things. They're viewed as having the force of law. Am I seeing that correctly?
Well, as far as executive orders covering state employees, they're human relations policies, they're employment policies. The state government, you know, operates as any other large employer would, and it would protect their employees from discrimination and harassment based on their sexual orientation and gender identity.
So this decision to not sign another executive order, as Governor Sebelius once had, to extend these protections, so what does it mean, Tom, for state workers who are gay, lesbian, transgender, or bisexual?
Well, what it means is if they're out at work, that they can be fired for being out at work. You know, these are people who came and took jobs or held jobs while they were protected by the previous order. And we are hearing now of LGBT state employees who are being harassed and fired because they are out at work. They are not protected, and these actions have been taken. We're aware of several.
I was going to say, so just to be clear, you're hearing that workers are actually being fired in Kansas, state government workers, because they're gay or lesbian or transgender or Yeah,
absolutely. Two women were in my office in Wichita just a couple of weeks ago. One was dismissed from Department of Children and Families office in Wichita at the Wichita office in February, and the other was suspended for 2 weeks but allowed to come back to work. And it was related to their sexual orientation. They're convinced of that, and so am I.
How are you convinced of that?
The explanation that they gave me and the documentation that they had at our meeting. They're afraid to come forward publicly, though, because one of the women is still employed there and doesn't want to lose her job.
How's Equality Kansas, the organization that you lead, how's it going to respond to this?
Well, we'd certainly like to respond publicly, but the problem is it, and this is what we face all the time, people need to find new jobs. People that have jobs need to be able to keep those jobs. And so there's a lot of reluctance on the part of people who are discriminated against because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. There's a lot of reluctance for them to come forward because it can harm their current jobs or their prospects for finding a job or even getting an apartment or another place to live.
Yeah, how many states offer protections to state government workers who are fall into the LGBT category?
Well, there's about 20 states that offer some discrimination protection based on sexual orientation or gender identity. So there's
just
about
20.
Yeah, about 30 states that do not.
Is that changing? Do you sense a shift there given the way society has shifted or not really?
There had been quite a bit of progress in the late 90s and through the 2000s. But since this so-called religious freedom movement started after 2010, there's been a lot less progress in states on passing non-discrimination protections for LGBT workers.
We're talking about the rights of LGBT workers in Kansas under the Jeff Collier administration and his decision to, at least not so far, sign a new executive order that would prohibit discrimination against LGBT state workers. The new governor, Tom, has said point blank that he won't tolerate harassment and discrimination in his administration. If there is any, he has said, he'll deal with it directly. Why isn't that enough of a promise of protection right there?
If we were going to take him seriously, and if he was serious about his words, he would put pen to paper and he would sign a new executive order. We're not holding our breath, though.
But he says he won't tolerate it.
Well, he also came to a hearing on an earlier religious freedom bill a few years ago as a lieutenant governor and testified publicly in favor of passing that so-called religious freedom bill. And that bill was specifically targeted at local municipalities and school districts that were passing ordinances and policies protecting their students and faculty and residents from discrimination based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. So for him to say he won't tolerate discrimination, it's empty words until he puts his signature on a piece of paper saying so.
Bottom line is you don't believe him.
Nope, not at all.
When Governor Brownback rescinded the executive order that Governor Sebelius had signed, Tom, he said he did so because those protections should be created by lawmakers and not through executive action. Did he have a point?
Absolutely not. Like any large employer, he, as the director of that organization with those 20 or 30,000 employees, can issue employment policies as long as they're otherwise consistent with the law that say you're not going to discriminate in this organization based on other employees' sexual orientation and gender identity. Large corporations across America have those policies. He could have done that and kept maintained those policies and issued new ones without any legislation being passed. It was perfectly within his power to do that.
I gather from your standpoint, in a perfect world, a law passed by the legislature would be preferable.
Well, in a perfect world, Steve, I would be back to my old occupation as a network technician.
I walked into that one, Tom. That's right. Yeah. But would a law be better?
Legislation would be great, and every biennial legislative session since 2006, we have introduced legislation that would add sexual orientation and gender identity to our state's non-discrimination statute.
What's the resistance to that? Is it this notion of creating yet another protected class? You hear that kind of rhetoric quite often attached to this issue?
Well, the rhetoric shifts with the political winds. Now the rhetoric that we're hearing is, oh, there's going to be big hairy guys in little girls' bathrooms, and that's why we can't pass that legislation. 10 years ago, the rhetoric around it was significantly different. It's a political issue that the other side loves to politicize. Otherwise, they wouldn't be introducing all these so-called religious freedom bills, like the one that we're going to be dealing with next week.
Which is?
Well, it would allow adoption agencies to refuse to place children with LGBT families. And these are agencies who operate with state contracts with taxpayer dollars.
I thought we were way down the road from this kind of issue in Kansas and Missouri and everywhere else for that matter.
We're not there yet. And the ironic thing about the bill that's going to be heard next week is it's being pushed by the Kansas Catholic Conference of Bishops. But right now, Catholic Charities, who around the country does a lot of adoption placement, has no state contracts and is not working for any state contractors to actually place children that are in state custody. So it kind of feels like they're just picking this fight for political reasons.
Are there other states that still bar LGBT individuals from adopting kids?
There are a couple of states in the Deep South that do, but those bans are falling as they're challenged in court.
And yet we're considering a new one in Kansas beginning next week.
Next week we'll be having hearings on a new one. Yes, that's right.
Now, I was struck when Governor Collier was asked the other day why he won't sign an executive order, which is what you want when it comes to protecting the rights of LGBT state workers. He said this: it is the policy, it is the law of Kansas, and I'm quoting here, we will not be dealing with these things. But he was incorrect in that remark. He didn't have his facts right. What did you make of that?
Well, what we made of it is that he was in the House, he was in the Senate, he was lieutenant governor, and now he's governor, and either he knows better and he was not being truthful, or he doesn't understand the very laws he's been put in place to enforce.
He's also tried to signal a change in tone from Governor Brownback. Do you see real change happening there or not?
Yes and no. As far as ideological tone, we haven't seen any real change. What we are seeing is some of the agency heads, the cabinet secretaries that he's putting in place, seem to be more professionally competent than the ideological appointments that Brownback had made.
So there is a difference there, then.
There is a slight difference.
I got time for one more question, Tom. The inevitable question, perhaps. Governor Collier is running to be governor in the August primary, and he faces, you know, a very tough opponent in Secretary of State Kris Kobach. How much of his decision to not extend these protections is political, in your view? How much of this is the governor wanting to court social conservatives who tend to turn out in big numbers at primary election time?
Oh, we think it's inherently political. That would go to explain all the attacks that have been leveled against our community over the past decade and his participation in those attacks.
That's Tom Witt. He's executive director of Equality Kansas. That's a group with a mission of ending discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Tom, thanks very much. Appreciate
it. Thanks for having me, Dave. Good to see you.